Today I'll try to tell you a little bit about what we and a few other groups have gathered about spin determination at LHC. This started with this paper, like our investigation started with this paper, and later on there are a couple of other papers that came out, and together with a senior student at Princeton, we're trying to finish up something which I'll mention sometime in the middle of the talk. But it's all related to spin determination at LHC. Okay, so the basic problem is that if we have an SUSY event at LHC, we would like to know out of this all this junk that comes out, and we determine the spin of any new resonance that hides in this pile of tracks and things like that. Now, of course, this picture is a little misleading because there is much more information available to us than just the position of things. There is also energy and momentum. So it's not as difficult as it seems like, but it's pretty difficult. Okay, so what is the question? Obviously, the question we'd like to answer is, can spin be determined at the LHC? But I think before you want to give an answer for this, there are a couple of other questions you want to understand before. And first of all, another the kind of odd questions that the theorist will ask, is there any spin formation to begin with? And I'd like to convince you that the answer to this question is actually not trivial. There are cases where there is no spin information available, and so obviously you're not going to determine spin at LHC, no matter how good your detector is. And a corollary to this question is just, what are the conditions for spin effects to be there for you to be able to measure them? And I think only after you answer these two questions very clearly, you can start investigating whether spin can be determined at LHC. So I'll spend quite a bit of time in this talk trying to understand where are those effects manifest themselves and what are the best channels to measure it. All right? So the first part, I'll just tell you what are the rules for the existence of spin effects. And I think those rules are so simple that you can just write down any Feynman diagrams after this talk and look at it and can tell yourself whether spin effects are there or are they not. You don't have to compute any actual Feynman diagram. And that's useful because it'll show you we'll end up just looking at all the SUSY or whatever your favorite model is, write down the Feynman diagrams, you'll immediately tell whether there is spin effects or there aren't. And it's also useful because it will tell us precisely when you don't have it or when you have a suppression of spin effects. So that those rules will become very useful. So then after we establish that, we'll try to figure out where can we determine the gauge boson partner spin. And then the meta partner spin. And finally, I'll just indicate some future directions which we think are useful to explore and some unresolved issues. All right. So let me first start by stating very clearly what are the assumptions, what are the working assumptions that I'm going to make to allow myself to talk about any of this. Okay. So first of all, the first assumption is that we can isolate some subset of events which we can dub new physics. Either statistically or event-by-event basis, we should be able to isolate some subset that we know new physics is there. If you cannot do that, this talk is futile. There is no hope you can do any of what I'm about to talk. So this is a strong assumption, but you know, you've got to start somewhere. So I'm going to assume we can isolate some subset of events. But moreover, in this subset, I need to be able to have some rough idea for what is the underlying topology of that event. If I have no idea what the topology of the events are, and I just know that there is some discrepancies on some tails of distribution or things like that, this is going to be pretty hard. Okay, so these are the two working assumptions I'm going to make throughout this talk. And one weak assumption I'm going to make is that there are some invisible particles. If there are no invisible particles, that is the very end product, if there are no invisible particles, the determination of spin is much easier because you can literally reconstruct things, go to the center of mass, and do the usual angular distribution type of derivative. So this assumption is mostly there just so there is anything to talk about. If you don't have any missing energy, it's pretty trivial. All right, so you can criticize any of those assumptions, but that's what I'm going to work with. So let's start by telling you what kind of decays I will consider. Where will I measure spin? I will imagine that there is some new resonance that decays into some observable particle, like a quark, through some intermediate guide, another observable particle, and something I cannot see. And my problem is that as a theorist, I know that there is another possibility that has the same kind of end products which I can observe, but the spin of the intermediate guides and the final product is different. And in this talk, I would like to find ways of determining the spin of this intermediate particle. And towards the end of the talk, I'll try to convince you that in certain cases, you can even determine the spin of the external unknown particles. Okay, but that part is a little more model dependent. So this is the basic idea behind this entire talk. That's what I'm going to try to do. Okay. Now there is a complementary method to that, and which relies on rates, because clearly if you have different spin, you have different degrees of freedom. Different degrees of freedom means different rates, either cross section or mostly cross section. And this was investigated in these three papers. The last one is from yesterday. But I'm not going to talk about that at all. Okay, that's a valid way to proceed, but it's also a little more model dependent, because you have to assume that you know exactly how many degrees of freedom you have. This one is a little less model dependent, but both should be pursued. Okay, so let me just start by giving you a standard model analog for what I'm about to do. Imagine you have the top decay into W, and you want to determine the W boson spin. Okay, so what do we have? We have a top goes to a bottom through a W and a neutrino and a lepton. Now the neutrino escaped detection, so I cannot reconstruct its energy momentum in general. In certain cases you can, but you need more constraints. But in general you cannot reconstruct the momentum of the neutrino, and therefore you cannot reconstruct the W boson mass. And you can still measure its spin. How do you do that? You define a Lorentz invariant, which is basically the invariant mass of the bottom and the lepton. And you simply look at the differential distribution of this decay with respect to this Lorentz invariant variable. And because this is a spin one particle, you will find out that this distribution is a polynomial of degree 2 in this relativistic invariant. Since this is a relativistic invariant, this statement holds in any frame, and I don't have to worry about going to the right frame or not. I just have to worry about being able to measure these two variables. Okay. So, throughout this talk, my point will just be the overlying point is just that different spin give you different polynomial dependency on relativistic variables. It's not a very deep point, but that's what I'm going to utilize. Okay. If you found that this is a linear function, you would know that this is a fermion. Of course, in that case, you'll violate Lorentz invariance, but that's a different story. Okay, so let's start by just reviewing some of the angular correlations. So, of course, what this corresponds to, what this relativistic variable corresponds to, is some angular correlation between the direction of the outgoing bottom and the direction of the lepton. Okay, so eventually what you're really measuring are angular correlations. The problem with angular correlations is that to make statements about angular correlations is frame dependent, whereas this variable is frame independent. Okay, so I'd like to talk about this variable instead of cosine and sine. But it's useful for our intuition to talk about cosine and sine for just a little bit. So we know that a fermion transform like such under theta rotation. So now we can imagine we have some polarized fermion, and it decays into some scalar and another fermion. And if we form the matrix element square, we find out that this matrix element goes as 1 minus cosine theta. Okay, so in general, so this fermion, of course, because of angular correlation, would like to go opposite to the direction of the incoming, the decaying fermion. Okay, nothing mysterious so far. The problem with this is that, of course, if this vertex is not chiral, I have an additional process where the same fermion decays to up polarized fermion. And in this case, the distribution goes as 1 plus cosine theta. Okay, so the first thing we can conclude very quickly is that if this vertex is not chiral, the full effect will be washed out. I will have no angular correlation. All right? But notice that aside from the chirality of this vertex, I also had to assume that the decaying fermion is polarized. If this decaying fermion was not polarized, I would have to write two more diagrams, and one of those diagrams will wash each one of the corresponding diagrams. Okay, so that's the problem with fermions. You need the vertex to be chiral, or at least partially chiral, and you need the decaying fermion to be polarized. All right. What about angular correlations in vector boson decay? There, the situation is a little simpler. It just depends whether this gauge boson is transversely polarized, I call it circular here, or longitudinally polarized. So, for example, when people measure Z to dileptons in a lab, they really literally form this distribution, and that's how we know the Z boson is a spin one. Okay. For the longitudinal, if it was longitudinally polarized, I'll get the opposite distribution. And of course, if it's not polarized, we just have to add those two distributions, and you'll get nothing. Right? You don't get any angular correlation. All right. Now, if you have a massive gauge boson goes to two other gauge bosons or two scalars, the behavior is exactly opposite. If it's circular, it's a sine squared behavior. If it's longitudinal, it's a cosine squared behavior. So the situation here is simpler because you don't have any requirement on the vertex per se. You just have to make sure that the decaying gauge boson is polarized. If something is not polarized, no matter what, you're not going to see any angular correlations. Simply, you don't choose any particular direction in space. Okay? But there's another important thing to notice here is that, as I said already, this one will have a behavior that goes as cosine squared theta. The fermion went like cosine theta. Okay, so again, there is this difference in the polynomial behavior. All right, so let's just summarize the conditions for spin effects. If I have some sort of decay like that, where X is some fermion in the middle, I either have to have, if X is a Dirac fermion, I need to have both vertices to be chiral. This vertex needs to be chiral because I want to have only one ellicity going through here. This vertex has to be chiral, so this fermion is polarized. All right? Now, if this is a Majorana fermion, it's a little more complicated because you need to have a charge information on those two visible fermions as well. But that's possible, for example, with double leptons. As I said already, if X is a gauge boson, the requirement is a little simpler. It has to be boosted. Okay, but what I mean by that, in a relativistically invariant statement, the statement is just that the masses of this through particle should not be too close to each other. Because if they're too close to each other, this gate does not have enough momentum, and it is not polarized. Okay. So that's more of a requirement on the spectrum. The spectrum should not be too degenerate. So the mass of this heavy new particle should not be too close to the mass of this guy. All right? But again, the reason why it's useful to mention them, to mention those conditions, is because now we can write any diagram and determine whether spin effects are present or not. Moreover, we know which limits to take so that we will see no effects, or which limits we want to take where the effect is enhanced. All right? Are there any questions on this end? All right. So the first group the first person to sort of take this seriously for the LHC and mention the possibility of spin measurements was Barr, and he considered the decay starting from a spark going to a quark as Rodich Rolino and producing through a lepton exchange two leptons and an LSP. Now, as I said already, you cannot reconstruct the LSP, so you have to form one of those relativistically invariant variables. And the problem is that you don't really know which fermion to connect with the jet. And this is going to be a problem through everything I'm going to talk about. Mm-hmm. But the way he decided to overcome it is defining a symmetry variable. And that symmetry variable is essentially the differential cross-section with respect to T for the lepton and for the electron and the positron, and subtract them. And this exhibits the right asymmetry to tell you whether this is a spin half or a spin one. Now, I'm not going to have much to say about this cascade because for a few reasons. First of all, it's been investigated by these groups. Second, it really does rely on a very particular spectrum because you need to have light leptons. But this is a valid thing to do. If you really do see light leptons, that would be a great channel to determine spin. It's probably not going to be very difficult. There is this issue of combinatorics. In particular, there is this issue of... there is not just this correlation. There is another squark in the event. And you need to find out how can you make sure that you're correlating with the right jet and not with the far jet. So there is this issue of combinatorics, but I think if you really see this at the LHC, it will be very easy to determine the spin of this event. Alright? But let's try to imagine scenarios where we don't have light leptons in the spectrum. Okay? Because if you're motivated by hierarchy problem, you'll pretty much just have gauge bosons and maybe tops. But there is no real reason to have leptons in the spectrum whatsoever. And in that case, things get a little harder. But there are still things to do. Okay, so what is the first diagram you can write down that has all the properties we talked about? The first one is the following. You have a squark decaying into a quark and a chargino. And this chargino can decay into a W and an LSP. And you go and you check your favorite SUSY reference, and you find that this vertex is indeed chiral. Okay. So you have a Dirac fermion going to Majorana, and this vertex is chiral. So there is hope. Well, there are spin correlations between the outgoing jet here and the W. Okay. Now, because this is a spin one, this is a spin half particle, you also know that this differential decay rate is a linear function of the invariant mass of these two outgoing particles. Okay. Whereas in the other scenarios, like little Higgs UED scenarios, the relevant diagram is this. And here, as we said, the only requirement is that the KK quark would be quite a little heavier than the W prime. And the differential decay rate would be a second order polynomial of this variable T. Okay? So this is what you want to compare. So in order to do that, since Pythia cannot do spin correlations, Pythia will not be able to produce the right decay rate for this thing, the differential decay rate. So we implement it in Helwig.
Yeah. Go to priest. So if the KK quark and W prime are very close to each other, then you just get small C1, C2?
That's right. So if there is a degeneracy here, mm-hmm. and there is a suppression of C2 and C1, mm-hmm. because essentially this W in the middle is not polarized. Mm-hmm. It's not longitudinally enhanced.
Are they suppressed at the same time? Is it possible that you get a very small C2, but then some still C1, so that you confuse things?
Oh, that's a good question.
And
I haven't thought about it.
Possible.
It's possible.
There is some parameter range.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's possible that you may confuse yourself to think that this is actually a linear behavior. But that's exactly the point that we're trying to understand. What are the conditions for these coefficients to be large enough so that you can conclude that it's indeed a second-order polynomial and not a first-order polynomial? In this case, it's simple because it's just rely on the chirality of these vertices. But in this case, as you noted, this is a continuous function of the mass difference. The mass difference square, actually. So, yeah. So we implemented into Herwig. We had to modify Herwig a little bit to be able to do the heavy spin one particle, the vector bosons. So this is the theoretical curve, and what we managed to produce from Herwig is something very similar. And so again, you know that there is this very strong second order polynomial behavior versus linear uprise. And of course, here you get the edge. Okay, so the behavior near the edge is not too different. If you take into account, if you don't care about the normalization, the behavior near the edge is not too different. So what you really want to see is this part. This is really the determining factor for the polynomial behavior. Now, of course, this does not include any collider effects, any detector effects. Okay, so what is the first problem you face? The first problem you face is that W's are not directly observed. They either decay hadronically or tectonically. So let's first ask, can we get some information if we just take the W go leptonically and correlate the lepton with the jet? And it turns out that because this effect is so strong, even if you take into account the lepton channel, there is still a discrepancy. So this is for a particular spectrum where the lightest one is 100 GeV, the middle one is 500, and the squark is a TeV. And the difference is that one is just rising and the other is trying to fall. Okay? And again, this is a plot of the invariant mass squared.
So which one is which?
Okay, so which one is which? This guy is the KK. This guy is Susie. So this guy is the KK and this one is Susie. Now, if you ask me why is it doing what it's doing, why is one doing this way and the other rising, that I don't quite understand, because it's quite far away from each other in phase space, but the correlation is still the same. But you can see already here, if you go further away, they're becoming the same. So the problem is that the question is whether this region is really accessible to you. Okay. Now there's one more problem here which I'm not going to talk about too much. The real problem is also that you don't really know which jet to correlate this lepton with. Should I correlate this lepton with this jet or should I correlate with this jet? Okay. And from our study where we just took both correlations, because this effect is so strong, you can still see a difference, statistical difference. Although it's no longer about comparing two polynomial behavior, because even here you cannot interpret it in terms of polynomial behavior any longer. But what I'm trying to emphasize here is that if you're about to claim something about the LHC, you want to have at the theory side, you want to have a very strong effect, because it will be washed out by the time you actually do the full collider simulator. And I think this is a very strong effect at the theory level. Okay? And that's why it still manifests itself even after you take into account. Now, by the way, this includes smearing and all those things, but it doesn't, we haven't thrown it through PGS or anything. It's just Herwig level. So it certainly does deserve some more attention, but I think it's hopeful. All right. You can also ask, what if I try to reconstruct a W boson? So we mentioned it over lunch that people start looking at the hadronically decaying W and trying to reconstruct the full W. The problem in that case is that so obviously background is an issue, and in this case even the SUSY itself or the same model has background, because you could be doing that, but the same new physics model can also do that. Okay, it has the same final four jet structure. But now you can ask, if I just take all the different jets in the events, okay, and just take all the combinatorics and throw them into the distribution and form their invariant mass, can I still see the W on top of all of this? I am sure you can. W is very pronounced. And there is a very simple reason for that. The reason is the following. If you take a 1 TeV object and you start decaying jets of them, those jets are pretty energetic, like they have a few hundred GeV of jets. The chances of you taking two few hundred GeV jets subtracting the four momentum, squaring it, and getting something which is 80 GeV squared is very small. Okay, it's more likely you'll get somewhere around a few hundred GeV. And this is why the W is still durable above. Just because those jets are very energetic, taking the difference between them, you're not going to get something as small as 80. So what is this plot supposed to illustrate? By the way, again, we included all the effects we could include, but there is certainly, this is not as good as an experimentalist can do it. But what we're trying to illustrate here is that it's not hopeless. I think it is hopeful that we can, in these sort of events, if you can really already know that those are new physics events, to be able to actually hadronically reconstruct the W, simply because any other difference will give you too large of a number. If you can do that, if you can tell which one of the two jets really is the W, then you can do jet W correlations instead of jet lepton correlations, and then the difference is even more pronounced, because in that case you still have this polynomial versus linear behavior. Okay, now these graphs also include the wrong pairing. Okay, so these graphs are basically the signal overriding some mispairing. Okay. As I said, why is it flat? Okay, so the reason why it's flat is because, as I said, you're doing the wrong correlations here. So one side did this. So this is your event. You want to do this correlation. Okay? These graphs also include this correlation. Okay? Now if you plot the differential cross section versus this variable, the invariant mass. As we said, for the correct correlation, we expect to see a distribution that looks like this. Mm-hmm. Right? But for the wrong correlation, because they're so far away in phase space, what you actually the actual distribution is something like this. And it just decays. Okay, but you see now that when you add those two distributions, because this has this decaying behavior, you actually end up getting something which is pretty flat. Okay, so this graph has both of them together.
But what about if you have a spin zero?
If you have a spin zero, I would say that you're just going to reproduce this curve. You're not going to get this flat.
You know the distribution of the dashed one, right?
That's good. So the point is that if I were an experimentalist, I won't do any of this. I would just take the matrix element and reproduce the full thing, right? And presumably I can definitely reproduce that, because this really doesn't carry any spin because they're so far away in phase space. So we'll just take a Monte Carlo and reproduce this behavior and match it to this. So I don't think you should take too seriously those graphs as the mean, like 5 years from now, experimentalists is not going to come up with this graph and say, hey, look, this is linear versus quadratic. They're going to come up with some fancy algorithm to do minimization and maximization of the residuals or whatever, and they're going to tell you it's spin one. The point of these graphs is more to show that there are cases where you cannot even tell in principle. So no amount of sophistication is going to help you if the vertices are not chiral. And the other point is just that even with these simple-minded tricks, you can tell them apart. So I think that's at least hopeful illustration.
So here, when you say taking combinatorics into account, that means you're allowing all combinations.
Yeah.
So if you go back a slide, you made a point about how you just take all combinations of jets in the event and you still get the W peak pretty pronounced. And so, in principle, if you used information, then you could do even better.
Yeah, I think you can do much better than this.
But the problem I have with this one is that there are going to be a lot of jets that aren't in your physics diagram.
That's right. So you're worried about funnel model jets.
I'm worried about a ton of background, yeah, and underlying event.
Right, so...
A resolution also is going to smear this way out.
In addition, yeah.
This includes smearing.
Resolution?
Yeah, this does include smearing.
You said you didn't put it through
GPS
or anything.
Right, so we just mocked it by taking the jet and
putting
Gaussian with fairly conservative values of it. But you see,
have
the reason.
Talked to Chris Tully or somebody into it?
We have not talked to Chris Tully about
this. Okay,
I
would talk to him.
He would be upset with me if I tell him about what I did.
What?
Well, he knows a lot about this.
I don't think we're going to get a peak that
sharp. He's a calorimeter.
Yeah.
Well, so I think the reason why you get such a sharp peak is because those are very energetic jets. Those jets that we constructed that were not at 80 GeV.
Right.
Those were at 500 GeV.
Yeah.
So they're a little sharper than... but anyway, I'm not going to argue with an experimentalist about how sharp this thing is going to be. It's probably
it'd
not...
It'd be great if it looked like this.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be as... It's not going to be as good as this, but...
I mean, your point is well taken that you could possibly.
Well, Jimmy's done it with full simulation and CMS with top, so he could comment.
Yeah, so I mean, we're getting the top from the WP3 pronounced.
But not that sharp.
Sure. Yeah, you have to do a lot of algorithms. You just plot the invariant mass, you just get this giant mess forever. Even with the
But that's such a dramatic peak that at least it gives you hope that you could maybe do something like this.
Right, so I think the general comment I have about this is that as a theorist, I can only do so much. But I think my role is to maybe prove that this is hopeful. But clearly the experimentalists can do a much better job on it. And even if I see something doesn't work quite well, surely the experimentalists can come up, hey, but I have this trick that I can do this and that and make this better, right? But I think our role as a theorist is maybe just point out that this possibility exists and it's not hopeless. It's actually pretty pronounced. But of course, if you do a realistic study, this is not going to be as good as that.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you can pull out some trick out of your sleeves that will circumvent it and, you know, make this completely irrelevant if you use a different variable or something. But, there is certainly some theoretical limits to what you can do, because certain cases you won't have any effect at all. Okay, so these graphs are just there to illustrate that the effect is very pronounced, and it's worth investigating. The other one that we're investigating with a student is, if you plot for your favorite SUSY reference, you find out that there's another vertex. There aren't too many chiral vertices, but there is one more vertex which is chiral, and that's the C2, C1, Z vertex. Okay? And again, the good thing about this is the Z can definitely be reconstructed, no question. And there is, of course, a similar situation in your favorite other model. And again, there is this difference in polynomial behavior, but we haven't done a full analysis, but I do want to point out a few things that we found. So what is the signal you would like to ask from this? It's three leptons, two jets, and missing energy, and two of the leptons reconstructing a Z. So if you look at it, you produce those things. There are only two dominant processes. Our signal, where a quark goes to a quark, a Z, and then a W and an LSP. But there is actually a background to that, same model background, where the first decay goes to a W and then a Z, okay? And then you'll get the wrong correlation. You'll correlate the Q with the wrong thing, okay? This is similar to the far near and far leptons that Barr encountered. Now, on top of that, there is also the other jet, as I said, in the events that correlating with that can also get you the wrong correlation. So what can you do about it? So we tried a few simple things that one can do. I'm not clear to me that you can do anything beyond that without fooling yourself. You can try, for example, how can I resolve the far versus near? Well, in this case, the squark decays to a quark and directly to an LSP. So the amount of energies that you have in this case is the approximately the mass square of this guy minus the mass square of the LSP, and that's quite larger than the mass difference between this part and this part, okay, because here is again the mass of the quark squared divided by the mass of 2 squared, which can, if m2 squared is much larger than m1 squared, you can have a large imbalance between those two sides. So then you can plot the PT of the two jets, and what we show here is that the PT of the right jet is usually much smaller than the PT of the wrong jet. Okay. So now a simple-minded thing to do is just to take to take the correlation with the wrong with the smaller PT. Okay. That's the most naive thing you can do, and I think that's probably the most you can do. The problem, of course, with this graph is how do you... Now, you can ask, why not put the line here? I can cut even better. But, of course, where you put the line depends on the other parameters of the model, which you don't know yet. So if I knew exactly where the masses were, I can probably do a better cut and put the line here. Okay, so where exactly that line... What the slope of the line is model dependent. But
so
if you...
Two unknown masses in each event? Or
there are...
More,
no,
three,
there are more.
There's three
unknown masses. There's the quark mass, there is M2, there is M1. Okay. This is one thing you can try, and I think it works fairly well. I'll tell you one thing about it soon. You can try something similar for the far Z versus the near Z. So remember we had this problem that we don't know far versus near. But again, you have...
If you know the mass, and you're saying you're not sure you can get better. Right? There are mass determination methods to do things.
If I know the mass, I think I can do better.
Okay.
No. But I don't want to make more statements than I know. So,
well,
but yes.
What this really relies on is you know some mass gaps. You just know roughly what the size of the different mass gaps. And then you can already... Because the kinematics of this are usually very sensitive to mass gaps. Not really. I mean, in the sense that I don't need to use absolute mass.
So, again, the other combinatorial issue we have is which z is the right z, but again, the mass. And this mass can be larger than this mass, in principle, and so I could have a situation where the PT of this Z is larger than the PT of this Z. Okay, and in this case, what I plot here, you can deconstruct a similar sort of plot, but what I show you here is that the ratio of right to wrong is a function of M2. So you see, as M2 decreases, you go to 0.5, because then the right to wrong ratio is exactly 1. Okay, so you get 0.5 and you subtract. But as M2 increases, of course, the PT of the right Z becomes more and more higher and higher, and you get higher purity. Okay, when M2 is much larger than M1. So that's a very clean way to, in that case, it's a very clean way to separate the two possibilities. But I think the thing you should ask yourself when you do something like that is always purity versus statistics. Because maybe that will help me to clear the signal a little bit, but maybe I'll lose some of the statistics that I've, you know, overall I've lost. So that's something we have not investigated in detail, but I think it's worth looking at. Okay, so let me move to a slightly different direction, and there I'll have less to say about the experimental part, more to say about the theoretical part. I think it's still interesting because there are some general statements you can make. So this section is about meta-partner screening. Okay, so again, let's review very quickly what are the conditions for spin effect. We said if X is a fermion, we need both vertices to be chiral, for example, in little Higgs. But in SUSY, that meta-partner is always a scalar, and for scalars, there are no angular correlations between the two outgoing guys. So we don't have to consider this at all, and we only have to consider what's happening here. Can we make any general statements about these two vertices? Okay. So since the star mole is chiral, I know that almost any new kind of heavy matter partner that I can think of will couple chirally. Okay, so they have there's some large Dirac mass, and I also write some Higgs coupling to those heavy guys. And then I have the gauge interactions, which have to be chiral because of the chiral structure of the star model. Now I say have to, but you know, theories can also always come up and say the other way of doing it. But this is fairly generic. Okay, those interactions are chiral. So those are the two kind of vertices you can have. You can have like a glue prime to left-handed, or a glue prime to right-handed. Okay, so you naively think those interactions are always chiral and always have spin effects. Okay, that conclusion is almost true, but not quite. Let's see why not. So the reason why not is actually already buried here, because you have these guys. And what I need to figure out is whether there are any mixing, because I know after electroweak symmetry breaking, the left-handed doublet will certainly mix with the left-handed singlet. And I have a matrix I can write down for that. That matrix has the Dirac masses on its diagonal and the Higgs coupling on its off-diagonal. And I can consider two cases. If they are completely non-degenerate, so this was some very, very general model of same spin scenario, some little Higgs model of what have you. And in this case, there is absolutely no mixing at all, because when you have such a matrix, those are generically smaller than the on-diagonal matrices. And so in that case, you have no mixing, and the vertices are always chiral. So we can conclude, in this sort of model, you will always see spin effects. Okay. Now, if those two are degenerate, so this is some sort of a UED type of model, where those two masses are somewhat degenerate. And what degenerate, I mean is that their difference is comparable to these numbers. Then in this case, whether there is mixing or not really depends on this angle that I wrote here. It turns out that UED predicts this angle to be pi, or rather, UED predicts that there is a relative minus sign between those two diagrams, and so UED predicts that you'll always have correlations, you'll always see spin effects. In a more general theory, this may not be pi, but we may be able to test UED in that sense. Okay, so how does that manifest itself? An example is dielectron correlation. You can consider some let's say a heavy Z, a Z prime decay to two leptons through some lepton prime and to a photon prime. Okay, and again you form this invariant combination. And you plot the histogram, and indeed the supersymmetric part is just flat because there are no correlations, it's an intermediate scalar. And the same spin scenario has linear dependence on this invariant mass variable. But of course, you can also ask, maybe those external guy was not a gauge boson, maybe it was a scalar. Or maybe the decaying particle is a scalar. Maybe they were both a scalar. So this brings us back to the thing I mentioned very early on, that can we say anything about the spin of the external particle on top of being able to determine the spin of the intermediate particle? So if we see a diagram like that, we clearly determine that the intermediate guy is a fermion rather than a scalar. But can we now go on and say something about the external particles as well? It turns out that the sign of the slope, whether it's positive or negative, removes a couple of these diagrams. Okay? Just because whether it's positive or negative tells you whether the two leptons like to be with each other or against each other, and that tells you something about spin angular conservation. Okay, so let me give you a particular example where you can determine all of the spin. So suppose you measure the Billy bar. Now this is very ideal scenario. You will probably not be able to do something so good, but this is just to illustrate a point. Suppose you measure the slope of the Billy bar to be negative. Okay, with the mass of this guy larger than the mass of this guy. And suppose you measure the slope of the dielectron distribution to also be negative, with again this requirement that the mass of this lepton is much larger than this guy as well. And then, either all three of them are vector bosons, or all three of them are scalars. Okay? Then, with a single spin measurement of the spin of this guy, a la bar, you just do lepton B correlation, you can now determine the spin of the entire new particles in the chain. Okay?
So I should imagine this is sort of a 3D thing where I have three different mass combinations and they lie on its surface, or do they correlation?
No,
it's a blob.
You're somehow assuming you know that this is the topology, is that right?
Right, so
yeah,
that
so, you know
so,
that.
So that was my first very first slide. So the assumption
in particular, even the order, I mean you know the order, and so you know something about the masses.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Now,
so I don't know if that's
no,
you're taking
okay.
that into account in your question.
No. I think it's
good. So again, this is very ideal because, as you said, I need to really know that this is a topology. But it just illustrates a point that there is a possibility of measuring the spin of the entire chain. Okay? Alrighty. Now, by the way, this requirement of the mass ratio goes back to this issue of polarization, that I need to know whether this is longitudinally polarized or circularly polarized. When this ratio is smaller than 2, this is transversely polarized. Okay, when this ratio is larger than 2, it's longitudinally polarized. Okay, that's why there is this requirement. Okay? Alright, there is one more thing with regard to fermions that, again, just thinking about these simple rules for when you see effects, you can immediately understand the following, that The requirement of chiral vertices can be formulated as just a requirement that the if you think about a Feynman diagram, right? So I have some. So corresponding to this fermion, I have some Q slash plus M propagator, right? Now the requirement that I have chiral vertices is just that I have some projection here and some projection here, so I kill either the Q slash or I kill the M. Okay, this is essentially the requirement of that the two vertices are chiral. But there is another way to achieve the same goal, right? I don't really need them to have any chiral vertices here. I could, for example, consider off-shell decays. In an off-shell decay, I know that the M piece dominates over the Q slash piece. That's the definition of an off-shell decay. Okay? So, in fact, he pointed out in the very first paper is that you will see spin effects, for example, in a decay like, if you imagine some heavy glue, or if you're thinking about split Suzy, some heavy gluino state decays through a squark, in this case there will be no correlations because this is scalar, versus the same situation in UED, where these are some two jets, this is some glue prime, gamma prime, this is some LSP. So, in this case, because this quark, this cube prime, is off-shell, you will always see angular correlations between those two jets. Okay, and this was taken up by Chavachandi et al. That realized this fact as well, and they investigated this type of topology. Now, again, as I said, it may be that the external particles are scalars rather than vector bosons. And you can form this thing, and here it is. So again, this is a graph of this invariant mass for different kind of models. So Suzy just follows phase space. There's the black line. The scalar fermion scalar model, which was this scalar fermion scalar model, follows this sort of distribution. The vector fermion vector model, which is what you'd call UED, for example, has this sort of distribution. So in that sort of case, you will always, you should always be able to determine whether you see Suzy or UED. Okay. That's another cute application of these rules. Okay, let me come to an end. Just point out a few things. So some future directions that one can explore. The experimental difficulties. I haven't spoken at all almost about the style model background. That was part of my assumption that you can actually isolate any of those events. But of course, you do want to worry about it at some point. Now, I think in the one case I mentioned where you require 3 leptons and 2 jets and missing energy, there's probably not much a style model background to that. But that also reduces the statistics a lot. So now the question is whether we can do this sort of measurements in an environment where there is more background. That we have not investigated. That will clearly modify this simple linear versus quadratic behavior, etc., etc. But again, because what you start with is so dramatically different, there is a good hope that you'll have something left. Okay. Second, can the correct pairing be determined and combinatorics reduced? I showed you one very naive way of doing it. It's not entirely clear that you can do much better, but one should always stay optimistic. There may be some clever way of doing it. There are clearly situations where there is no hope of doing it because the wrong combinatorics give you a good kinematics as well, and so there is no way you can tell the difference. But in certain situations, you should be able to tell the difference. Another important thing is how well will B-tagging work? And the reason why I mentioned that is because in that case, you may be able to use things like gluino to B bar and some neutralino and try to correlate the BB bar. But for that, you need to be able to know that it was a BB bar. So that's important, B tagging and flavor tagging as well, in general. So all of those things will be useful to have a better understanding. I should probably add to this list how well can we reconstruct the W hadronically. I don't know how much me as a theorist can say about how well we can reconstruct the W hadronically and have the experimentalists believe those results, but it may be useful to understand that. Okay, now some new methods and new directions. So recently, out of Davis came out an interesting paper by Cinchia and collaborators on a new type of way of measuring masses. I don't have any idea, but it would be interesting to look if whether that sort of method can also help you determine the spin. The nice thing about this method is it's completely algebraic. You just set up a set of the Diophantine equations, and you solve them, and you get some constraint on the kinematics, and eventually, after some iteration, you converge on the masses. It's not entirely clear where spin formation will lie in here, but maybe it is, and if it is, this is a much more systematic way of determining spin rather than plotting nice graphs. As I said, the other complementary method to all of this is that of rate information, and I think that should be pursued because if nothing else, this will be a cross-check on this sort of measurement. It's always useful to have several things working for you. Okay, so let me just conclude. I think one advantage of our work is just that the conditions for spin effects, which is a reminder, the first question I think you should answer when spin effects manifest themselves, are now extremely clear. You can write any Feynman diagram and immediately tell whether spin correlations are there or not. If they're not there, there's no point of proceeding. No amount of experimental machinery will help you determine the spin. Second, this helped us identify now quite a few channels where spin actually exhibits itself. And it will be useful to try to investigate those channels more realistically possibly. And I think something to take from this talk is maybe just a word of caution that just because you concluded that something is a flat distribution does not mean that you found a scalar. Because as I showed you, there are many situations where you will have no spin effects, but yet the underlying physics has fermions. So seeing no signal does not mean that you, I don't know how to say it beautifully, but seeing no signal
evidence.
Does not
absence of evidence is not
Thank you.
Evidence of absence.
That's right. Thank you. and I think this illustrates it very clearly.
Is that a string theory study?
No, that was Donald Ross.
Well, that's not wrong.
Yeah.
It was Carl Sagan who said that first.
Really?
Oh.
He stole it?
Everybody goes back to Carl.
Okay, so I think I'll end here.
If we don't have a Cairo versus or boost the gauge buildup, can ketosis method work?
Yeah, I think so. Let me think. So in his case, he relied on the fact that you have E plus E minus, and then the initial beams are already polarized. Not because you polarize them, just because those are relativistic fermions, so they're either going this way or that way.
Which method? What was the question?
There are a couple of papers by Hitoshi and
for linear collider?
They did it for linear collider, but they are hopeful.
I think they are also trying to do it on Hevesham QQ bars.
Yeah.
Not that different.
I think there is part of it which just does rely on the vertex structure, but I have not looked in detail.
Yeah, coming from the interference, suppose you have a problem with spin, then if you have an intermediate problem where the spin goes up and down, then interference gives you the phi dependence.
I think, yeah, they're really looking at, if you see a particle, they're really looking at it tells you a direction, they look really looking at angular distribution around that direction. So, and of course, you are cut off by the dilution of volume.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, otherwise.
But I think for their method, I don't know if they've made advances on it, but at least the first thing they proposed, you really needed to be able to reconstruct the momentum of those guys.
Yeah.
And for that, it was essential that this is a E plus E minus collider, so you have enough constraints to be able to reconstruct the full thing.
If you can rest, if you have a resonance, for example, and you could reconstruct its rest frame somehow, and you knew that it was created from QQ bar, even at the LHC. So I think actually these KK gluons satisfy that. I think those are actually dominantly created by QQ bar,
and they're polarized.
So then you could use this.
Yes. Yeah. So in that case, they're polarized simply because the incoming particle. It's like a Q and a Q bar. And even though they're not intrinsically polarized, because they are so relativistic, they're either, and they're coupling to a gauge boson, so they're either this way or both the other way, simply because of relativistic invariance. And then the gauge boson is either circularly polarized left-handed or circularly polarized right-handed, but there is no longitudinal mode.
That's the reason you give you.
Yeah, that's the reason why at left,
close.
You see, and when you plot the cosine distribution of the dielectrons about the beam axis, you see this. That's the reason. Because
in that case, this just would be the first item.
For example, if we see a Z prime,
or a Z prime, yeah.
That's what we'll do.
Yeah.
There's one thing I didn't mention, but I think is a little cute, which is related to this Z prime issue, and that is. Imagine that really this is what we have. We have some QQ bar, it goes to some Z prime, and Z prime goes to W plus, W minus. And imagine further that you manage to measure the cosine theta behavior exactly, and you plot it, and you found that it does this. Okay? So you'll conclude this is a state intermediate guy, it's a spin 2, and spin 1, right? And for a moment you'll be happy, but then you'll be very confused. Because remember one of the very first slides I showed was that actually, for a gauge boson, the correlations are exactly opposite. That's the problem with animation. Okay, so for a gauge boson, if you decay a two gauge boson, the distribution is exactly opposite to what I drew. Because we know it's we know this one is transversely polarized. And so I should get I should get this diagonal, I should get this distribution. But instead I'm saying this. What's going on? What you'll conclude is actually that this vertex is an anomalous vertex involving the epsilon tensor. Okay? And because when you have something like this, epsilon mu nu alpha beta, z mu line of di alpha di beta, with this sort of vertex, you will get exactly the opposite behavior. This follows simply because in this case, you cannot have both of the w's longitudinal. Okay, so if we end up seeing something like that from this, we have seen an epsilon tensor sort of structure. So I think this is sort of cute, but it's something to keep in mind, that this can be violated in one instance if you have an anomalous vertex. But, yeah. All right.